The thoughts we think affect us all. The way we build our attitudes with love or hate we make, a bridge or wall. Today we begin to explore the topic of women's issues in Islam. We live in a world in which many a wall has been built by prejudice, by Islamophobia, racism, sexism, by our own unthinking assumptions. As Unitarian Universalists, we do our best to open our minds, open our hearts, to critique stereotypes and examine assumptions, all toward the end of living out our first principle, to affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of every person. As Jennifer and Lance light the flame of our faith, let us set our minds and hearts on that intention, mindful that we take on this challenge together with the guidance of our faith and the support of one another. Let's remain seated and join in singing together our choral response, which is number 389 in your hymnals. We will sing it twice through. The words are written by Saadi, one of the most well-known and well-respected authors of Persian ethical and humanitarian literature. Saadi studied and practiced the mystic form of Islam called Sufism. This text comes from Bostan, a book of poems on ethical and mystical subjects, including anecdotes which illustrate the standard virtues recommended to Muslims. Will you please join me in reading responsively? I will begin with the plain text. To worship God is nothing other than to serve the people. All peoples are members of the same body, created from one essence.
If they bring suffering to one member,
the others cannot stay at rest. Our Unitarian Universalist faith says much the same thing. We are interconnected in this web of life. The suffering of one affects us all. Thus, we do what we can to make the world a better place for everyone. One of the ways by which we do this in our congregation is by sharing the offering plate. Our meditation begins with a hymn, number 194 in your hymnal. 194, Faith is a Forest. Let us use this moment of shared silence to each connect with that in the web of life that gives us comfort and strength. Let us hold in our hearts those we love, as well as those in the wider world that need our care. Let us listen for the still small voice that helps us live as the loving and open-hearted people we long to be. Breathe in, breathe out. As Unitarian Universalists, we uphold freedom of belief. We have among us atheists, theists, spiritual humanists, and more. We learn from one another's different religious traditions and backgrounds, be they Christian or Jewish, Buddhist or Hindu. As Unitarian Universalists, we also affirm the equality of people of all genders. So how are we to respond when someone condemns Islam as a religion based on claims of its unequal treatment of women? I will own up front that this whole topic makes me anxious. It seems like one of those situations where I could inadvertently end up doing more harm than good. Furthermore, when I read examples of this debate online, both sides were laced with a tone of disrespectful arrogance that made me queasy. Mean-spirited insults that essentially said, clearly you are too stupid to see the truth that I know. It makes me want to bury my head in the sand. And yet, I know that I can't ignore it. I live in a diverse Canadian society, and I am a member of a Unitarian Universalist religion which urges us to wrestle with and figure out how to support pluralism in all of its complexity. I am thus compelled to figure out if there is a way to respond that does more good than harm. We'll start by looking at a sample overview of the debate, minus the insults. Person A will say, Islam oppresses women. Person A cites examples of Muslim women in the world who face violence, abuse, and oppression. Perhaps you recall, for example, the Globe and Mail's 2009 film series, Behind the Veil, which interviews Muslim women in the conservative city of Kandahar, Afghanistan, who were struggling for self-determination in education and marriage within the context of political unrest that exacerbated the difficulty and danger of their daily living. Person A says that Islam oppresses women and therefore Islam is a bad religion. The implication often extends to the practitioners of that religion, condemning Muslim people as a whole. Person B responds with, "You are blaming a whole religion, a whole people, for the acts of fringe extremists. That's not fair." Person B usually also points out that all the other religions that have had extremists doing evil in the name of their religions, the Christian Bible, for example, has been used throughout history to justify slavery, oppression of women, and homophobia. Person B will point out that sexism in particular has a long history in a wide array of world religions. Women are treated as property, told to obey their husbands, even submit to abuse. They are denied leadership roles and entry into the clergy. Christian, Jewish, even Buddhist women have had to fight for ordination rights. Person A then either argues that, yes, all religions are bad, the world would be better off without religion, or person A will argue that Muslim women are being oppressed by their religion in higher numbers and in worse ways than are women in other religions. Then person A and person B fall into a rabbit hole, an endless back and forth debate about which religion has committed worse atrocities, which produces no clear answer and no clear victor. So what is a good intentioned Unitarian Universalist to do? On the one hand, just as I support all women who are working for equality, I want to support Muslim women who are doing the same. On the other hand, I am wary. I recall the harm that has been done to by people like me trying to, quote unquote, help someone in a culture different from their own. Think of the residential schools in Canada and the legacy of abuse and damage suffered by Indigenous peoples. Some of the people in power in the residential school system were, as we know, abusive and unabashedly racist. But some Canadians of European descent supported that system because they thought it was doing good. Unaware of the racist subtext of their position, they thought the schools were giving Indigenous people a better education than they would get from their own people, an education that would help them assimilate into the settlers' more, quote-unquote, civilized culture. They were wrong, of course. So, as a non-Muslim person of European descent, living in a Western culture that fills our heads with stereotypes of both Muslims and people from the Middle East, I am wary. How easy it would be to make assumptions and, in my ignorance, make things worse in my attempts to help Muslim women gain equal rights. In short, I do not want to be this woman. The non-Muslim woman on the left shouts, "Hang in there, we will free you," as she tries to snatch the hijab off the Muslim woman's head, who cries out in protest, "God, no!" What is a good UU to do? When I look to our own Unitarian Universalist tradition for guidance, I'm reminded of the following. One, much like the Sa'adi quotation we read earlier, our UU theology of interconnection calls us to care for others that suffer. Two, we have a long history of working for equality of all people, working against prejudices that sustain oppressive systems. Three, we also have a tradition of respecting a wide variety of diverse points of view, belief, and experience. And four, one of the reasons that we are successful at holding such pluralism is that we have a high tolerance for complexity. We don't try to reduce complex situations with overly simplistic judgments, good versus bad, right versus wrong. We try to understand the full complexity of an issue, allowing for a wide range of different human experiences and truths. And it is this nuanced understanding that I think is needed here. Consider this illustration. The man on the left, looking at the woman in the middle, says, headscarf, too fundamentalist. And the man on the right, looking at the same woman, says, jeans, too liberal. The woman in the middle says, so what, you can't please them all anyway. If non-Muslims like me are to support Muslim women, we need to understand that they face prejudice and judgments from all sides. A Muslim woman, like all women in this world, faces sexism and all sorts of restricted ideas about how a woman should be. She also faces Islamophobia and a whole range of prejudiced assumptions that come with that, that she is dangerous, that she's a fundamentalist, that she is oppressed. If she is a woman of color, she faces an additional layer of racism. Even in our multicultural Canada, Islamophobia can make life scary for Muslim women. Amira El-Gawahabi, the communications director at the National Council of Canadian Muslims, reported in June that, quote, anti-Muslim hate crimes in Canada have been on the rise for several years, doubling between 2011 and 2014, while hate crimes in general have been declining. The most targeted victims of anti-Muslim hate are visibly Muslim women who wear religious attire. Last November, a mother was beaten up in broad daylight on her way to pick up her children from school. Sadly, that is only one example of many. End quote. You have now no doubt heard the stories. Muslim women born in Canada told by strangers, go back where you came from. Muslim girls who get teased on the playground for wearing hijab. Jobs denied Muslim women because they don't fit the image of the company. Islamophobia has its roots in Orientalism. You may recall the 1978 book by Edward Said titled Orientalism that became the foundational document for the field of study called post-colonialism. I found a quotation that sums up the thesis nicely and sadly still seems very relevant. Quote, the book Orientalism tries to answer the question of why, when we think of the Middle East, for example, we have a preconceived notion of what kind of people live there, what they believe, how they act, even though we may never have been there or indeed even met anyone from there. The central argument of Orientalism is that the way we acquire this knowledge is not innocent or objective, but the end result of a process that reflects certain interests. That is, it is highly motivated. Specifically, Said argues that the way the West, Europe, and the U.S. looks at the countries and peoples of the Middle East is through a lens that distorts the actual reality of those places and those people. He calls this lens through which we view that part of the world Orientalism, a framework that we use to understand the unfamiliar and the strange, to make the peoples of the Middle East appear different and threatening. End quote. Orientalism points out that these prejudices were not just run-of-the-mill people being uncomfortable with difference. These prejudices were deliberately encouraged and perpetuated and then used by people in power to achieve their own ends. In the old days, it made it easier to support the wars that invaded and stole other people's lands, i.e. colonialism. Today, a similar tactic of fear-mongering is used to win elections. Or, I guess, lose elections in the case of our country. But I read one article about last fall's election that did a great job of explaining how politicians manipulated the public with the proposed ban on niqab and the proposed measures against, quote-unquote, barbaric cultural practices. Both were supposedly out of a concern for women. But, the article points out, those same politicians showed little to no support for any number of measures about women's safety, from cutting funding for women's shelters to ignoring the more than 1,800 indigenous women that have gone missing or been murdered since 1980. The politicians argue that the effort to ban barbaric cultural practices was to prevent things like so-called honor killings. But the article points out, Canada already has laws against murder. Domestic violence is not exclusive to Muslim communities. Sadly, it happens all the time, perpetrated by people of many different religions and no religion at all. The article argues that we need laws and safety resources that help protect women, not laws that stereotype, marginalize, and villainize Muslims. Sexism, racism, and Islamophobia. Muslim women are up against a lot. One way to work against these stereotypes that swirl about Muslim women from all sides is to help broaden the public's understanding of what a Muslim woman can be. Western media, especially, feeds us a very narrow representation of a Muslim woman: Middle Eastern, dark-skinned, covered, oppressed. But in fact, as with women in all religions, Christian, Jewish, Buddhist, Hindu, and more, there is huge diversity in the global Muslima community. Muslim women live on every continent, in countries all over the world. There are a variety of different races and ethnicities. Like all human beings, they hold a variety of interests, talents, and careers. Here is a small sampling. Since we are in the Olympic season, I'll start with two athletes. There's Olympic volleyball player Doha El Ghobashi from Egypt, Olympic fencer Ibtihaj Mohammed, an African-American Muslim from New Jersey, Sakdia Muraf, a stand-up comedian in Indonesia. Right, you go, girl, right? Irshad Manji is a Canadian author, educator, and advocate of a reformist interpretation of Islam. She is an out lesbian and a practicing Muslim. Zaina Anwar is a Malaysian organizational leader and activist. She is currently the director of Musawa, a global movement for equality and justice in the Muslim family. And Shirin Ebadi, you probably know, is an Iranian lawyer and former judge who won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2003 for her pioneering efforts to promote democracy and human rights, especially for women and children. And then there are the regular people. Here are some young women who were featured in an article called "What Is It Actually Like to Be a Muslim Girl in Canada?" They each write their own essays. I put a link on our Facebook page. I urge you to look at it. They're phenomenal women, young women. There is a huge diversity amongst Muslim women in the world. Those photos don't even begin to do the diversity justice. Moreover, different Muslim women interpret and practice their religion in a wide variety of ways. Many Muslim women choose interpretations of Islam that support the equality of women. Many follow the scholarship of people like theologian and Islamic feminist scholar Rifat Hassan, who states, quote, "Not only does the Quran make it clear that man and woman stand absolutely equal in the sight of God, but also that they are members and protectors of one another. In other words, the Quran does not create a hierarchy in which men are placed above women, nor does it pit men against women in adversary relationship. They are created as equal creatures of a universal, just, and merciful God, whose pleasure it is that they live in harmony and in righteousness together. End quote. Hassan quotes the Quran, "And their Lord answered them, 'Never will I suffer to be lost the work of any of you, be he male or female, ye are members of one another.'" And the believers, men and women, are protectors of one another. They enjoin what is just and forbid what is evil. On them, God will pour his mercy. Those verses show that men and women are equal in God's eyes. There are also verses that specifically tell men to treat women fairly, like this one. "Believers, it is not lawful for you to inherit women against their will. Always treat your wives reasonably." Some translations say, "treat your wives kindly." "If you dislike them, you could be disliking that which God has filled with abundant good." People who see in the Quran this egalitarian spirit say that it has been twisted over the centuries by patriarchal leaders who translated the Quran in ways that support the sexist norms that keep them in power. Look at any parallel set of translations of Quranic passages, and you will see how easily this could happen. There's quite a lot of variance between the different translators, even for the verses that are not at all controversial. Other scholars point out that at its founding in the 6th century, Islam actually granted to women more rights than many other religions did of that era, including the right to education, the right to earn, keep, and inherit their own money, the right to take part in politics, economic affairs, and the military, and the right to choose their spouses and divorce them. The Prophet's first wife, Khadija, is regarded by many as a role model, for she was an accomplished businesswoman and landowner whose husband, the Prophet Muhammad, heard and heeded her counsel. It's worth noting that it's not just women who choose these more egalitarian interpretations. There's a whole progressive movement within Islam. The progressives understand that there's not just one way to interpret Islam, but many different ways. Omid Safi, editor of the book Progressive Muslims, explains that within its 1,400-year history, there is, quote, "an incredibly rich and diverse spectrum of interpretation and practices." Safi says, "It is precisely that fluidity of Islamic interpretation and practice that people find so useful. It's been one of the great hallmarks of Islamic tradition that you always have had a plurality of voices and interpretations and practice, more or less side by side, however grudgingly, acknowledging the validity of the other interpretations, even if one disagrees with them." End quote. We were talking about broadening the public's understanding of what a Muslim woman can be and increasing awareness of the wide range of interpretations of Islam, including those that support gender equality. As a corollary to this, it's important for us to understand the wide range of views on the decision to wear or not wear hijab, niqab, or other coverings. I remember how surprised I was when I learned in grad school that some feminist Muslims chose to wear the hijab. I've since learned that, contrary to stereotype, many Muslim women do not feel forced into wearing such coverings, nor do they see it as a sign of oppression. Some say it's a personal reminder of their faith, like we might wear a chalice necklace or a Christian might wear a cross. Some Muslim women wear hijab, say that they like that it puts the focus on their words and ideas rather than on their body. Some say it's a part of self-respect and self-esteem, treasuring one's body as a temple, uncovering one's head only when one is home with loved ones. Other Muslim women choose not to cover their heads at all. You're probably familiar with the debate on this issue, often involving non-Muslims who are all too eager to throw their opinions and judgments into the mix. On the one hand, some people argue that it is giving in to sexism to cover up. And on the other hand, others argue it is giving in to sexism to reveal too much, as is illustrated here. The woman in the bikini says of the woman in the niqab, "Everything covered but her eyes. What a cruel male-dominated culture." And the woman in the niqab says of the woman in the bikini, "Nothing covered but her eyes. What a cruel male-dominated culture." The truth is, they are both right. Sexism affects us all, no matter how we dress. In the face of that truth, I'm thinking it makes more sense to support a woman's right to choose what she wears and to defend her right to be respected as a human being regardless of the extent to which her attire covers or reveals. Just like all women, different Muslim women make different choices about what they wear. Our challenge is to not make assumptions about what that choice means. Different women will have different reasons. Another way to fight the stereotypes of Muslim women who do choose to wear the hijab or niqab is to broaden the public's awareness of the latent Islamophobia that shades our Western culture's judgments of such women. Many have pointed out, for example, this disparity. In the West, a nun in a habit is viewed as devoted, whereas a Muslim in similar attire is viewed as oppressed. Of course, those who have a knee-jerk reaction against all religions will judge both women as oppressed. So again, as you use, we would urge a more nuanced understanding of the diversity of experience and choices of religious women. They may not experience it as oppression. Their clothing choice may, on the contrary, make them feel centered, peaceful, confident, and strong. Who are we to judge? But putting that issue aside, it is striking to note that Muslim women really do get the short end of the stick. Various countries have considered bans on the hijab. I have never heard of anyone speak of banning nuns' habits. After doing all this learning and thinking, I am renewing my resolve to do what I can to work against sexism, racism, and Islamophobia in all their subtle and not-so-subtle manifestations. One of my favorite women's rights organizations is the Global Fund for Women, which empowers women all over the world. The Global Fund for Women also has a special campaign called #MuslimaMeans, Muslim Women Shattering Stereotypes, that is a powerful forum for Muslim women, artists, activists, photographers, leaders, and everyday people to lift up their voices and share their ideas and experiences. I've put a link to their virtual art gallery on our congregation's Facebook page. This next project is not from that website, but it's the kind of thing you will find there. It's called 24 Reasons to Challenge Islamophobia from students at Warwick University in England. I'll show you four of them. Challenge Islamophobia because I shouldn't be asked whether I'm going to Syria at the airport because I wear a headscarf. Challenge Islamophobia because I could be your sister, daughter, or friend. Challenge Islamophobia because I should not have to worry about my mom who wears a hijab. And from the chancellor of the university, challenge Islamophobia because stereotypes are lazy and dangerous. I end with our original question. If someone says to you, "Islam oppresses women," how will you respond? Whatever we say, I hope we will do it with humility and grace. I hope we'll avoid that nasty tone that was in the debates I read online, the "I'm right and you are stupid" tone. It's complicated. We are all doing our best to figure out how to do more good than harm. Let us infuse our language and our actions with the love of our intentions. This is the message of our next hymn, number 34, in your hymnal. We will close with words from UU Minister Reverend John Brigham. Go your ways, knowing not the answers to all things, yet seeking always the answer to one more thing than you know. So may it be.